Hello and welcome to the Monocle Summer Weekly, a Monocle 24, with me, Daniel Giacopelli, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be keeping things summery with Eileen Cooper, Keeper of London's Royal Academy. The painter, who's in charge of the institution's celebrated annual summer exhibition, will be joining us to tell us how this year's, and indeed the last 10, have gone.
And we'll be heading down to Brazil to investigate some hot literary talent. Monocle's reporter Frederick Burness has been at the Paraty International Literary Festival, also known as FLIP. We'll be getting the full story later.
Plus, we'll get into the mindset of Portuguese street artist Vils to learn how the bright talent from Lisbon is spreading his work around the world.
And Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan is back with some of the next week's big stories. And we'll enjoy some more music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly, on Monocle 24.
Well, there you go, Danny. Another week bites the dust, and it's you and I here this Sunday on the Monocle Summer Weekly for August only. And I guess we should explain
why that
this
is.
This sort of celebrates the other Monocle Summer Weekly, our fantastic August weekly newspaper, which is on all good newsstands now. We're just kind of sending issue 2, which will be out later in the week. It's summer. It's sunshine. It's great seasonal content on the printed page. And we thought we'd sort of, I don't know, rekindle, reboot the weekly to mark that.
You know what, Tom? I'm going to a beach in just a few days. I might even bring issue 1 with me.
It's the perfect beachside.
I can't get enough.
Perfect beachside read. And so, of course, regular listeners will also notice a definite uptick in sunshine content on the programme. We'll be having fun in the sun, as I mentioned, whether it's heading to Brazil or celebrating the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition right here in London. Shall we kick things off, Danny, with if you want
a crystal ball.
Well, and a summary. Do you see what I've done there?
I got it.
One with an E, one with an A. It's clever. Doesn't work so well.
You're a smart man.
Not on the printed page. Let's get Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan into the studio.
Henry, oh Henry.
And here is Henry Rhys Sheridan with the summary, if you will, a summer news look ahead.
Thanks very much, Tom. Let's start with the summeriest dance, to my mind anyway. From the 14th of August to the 23rd of August, it's going to be the Tango World Cup contested. Where else? In Buenos Aires. Now, I was watching some videos of tango before I came down. Haven't seen it in a while. I haven't really concentrated on it in a while. I might have seen, you know, the occasional clip on television. An unusual dance, unusual clothing conventions as well. Mm. The women dressed very elegantly, but quite sexily too. Quite revealing dresses on the ladies.
Latin passions.
The men, on the other hand, you're familiar with the seminal Talking Heads concert documentary Stop Making Sense.
Of course, Henry.
You know the bit when David Byrne interviews himself wearing a massive suit? It's that kind of thing going on.
Do the suits get bigger and bigger and bigger, as his suit does in that movie?
I don't think I watched it for long enough.
So how does one win this competition, Henry? It's a World Cup. There is a winner, presumably.
Do the best tango. I'm not sure what the judges score on, how they weight different aspects of the dance performance. I can tell you that there are two contests. The more traditional milonga ballroom tango and a more European-style choreographed tango. Either of you ever danced a tango in your life?
No, but I'm actually a big fan of tango music, to be honest.
Are you?
Astor Piazzolla, famous accordionist.
Impressive knowledge. Tom, can you raise Danny on that or no?
No, I can't.
Fabulous musician.
I will tell you one interesting tidbit of information. Oh. Do you know where there's also a very, very vibrant tango scene? And indeed, I think the biggest tango festival outside of Argentina.
Hit me.
Finland!
Really?
You did not see that coming, did you?
Culturally, climatically.
Doesn't seem right, but the
Finns. It couldn't be further away from the home nation of tango.
Our mutual colleague, Marco Sippi, will tell you more about why the Finnish have this enduring love affair with tango, and it's fascinating.
Why is it?
That is really bizarre because the Finns are known for kind of being a bit shoegazy. They're a bit introverted. They're not that.
Well, I think it's cooler. It's a cooler culture, both in terms of the prevailing atmospherics and in terms of the
sensibility.
Character and sensibility. And yet, maybe they need a bit of life. Look, they love sauna. So maybe they like a bit of steaminess here and there.
Okay, what else is happening?
Moving on, Henry, what else is happening?
Moving on the 16th of August, the Palio di Siena.
Ah, I know all about this.
This is good as well.
Is taking place in Italy.
Have you seen the brilliant documentary about this?
I haven't actually. Well, why do you know about this?
I've seen the movie.
Really? It's quite famous.
So it's the world's most famous horse race.
Tell me about it.
These ancient families all compete against one another. Not just families, but they're kind of like houses. It's like Harry Potter, if you will. Henry.
Romeo and Juliet,
being a youngin.
But...
So you kind of sign up to one of these competing houses, and you essentially race around the main public area in the middle of the city.
The press release I have tells me that the race consists of bareback riders making three circuits of the main square.
It's astonishing. It's absolutely
remarkable. It's honestly incredible, because the drama behind all of this, it's like a soap opera, what goes behind everything. And this brilliant documentary, just called Palio, documents kind of the various people involved and the characters
intrigue.
And the trainers. And yeah, it's so good.
Oh, I didn't realise it was as well known as it is.
I'm looking forward to what I like about this is we're sitting here on the sort of Monocle Summer Weekly, and we've found these events that have this febrile heat, the summer quality, the dust in the nostrils, the sun beating down.
Foam around the mouth.
And that's just the competitors, not
indeed.
Even the horses.
Indeed.
But we're really capturing that summer essence. I'm loving this so far, Henry. Can you continue to shine like a beam of summer sun with your next item?
Let's see. From the 14th of August to the 21st of August, all of next week, it's national, in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, afternoon tea week.
Oh, my God.
That's all right. That's also summery. Are we talking cup of classic tea, scone, clotted cream, bit of jam? This is where we're at.
Dump it all in the harbour, I say.
Dump it all? Was that some kind of reference to the ingrate in America?
I'm still peeved about that.
Go on.
I think I mentioned this to you a few, because this actually came up on my radar a few days ago. I think I mentioned it to you. It's a more recent convention than I initially thought.
Yep.
In only 1840 was it invented by Anne, the 7th Duchess of Bedford. She started requesting tea, bread and cake.
Because it's the little finger sandwiches as
indeed,
well.
Indeed,
I was describing
not the Atkins diet.
On the
West
tiered,
country.
On a kind of tiered server. What would you call that? A kind of
tea stand. I don't know what you'd call it. Yeah.
4 p.m. is a traditional serving
perfect.
Hour. It's meant to stave off hunger.
What's interesting about Henry? You mentioned this idea of these constructs, these inventions, fabrications. It's like the traditional ploughman's lunch.
Tell me about that.
Which you imagine was, you know...
Maybe explain that for our international
well,
listeners.
Basically,
I'm not sure of it.
It's cheese and bread and pickles.
That's it.
And onions.
And an onion.
Which is
a
why
bit of
like
wet
it.
Lettuce if you're lucky.
And the idea, it conjures this notion of, you know, the ploughman at the field at his tiller hundreds of years. Completely invented.
Really?
Yeah. It was a marketing ruse invented in the middle of the 20th century.
God.
Remarkable.
So there's lots of fun things like that. But yeah, the classic English afternoon tea is something really rather special. And I understand Danny's cynicism, but
it's
I still
also,
think
it's also expensive.
You need to do it properly at least once.
It's expensive too. People think it's just tea and like a cookie. It's not. It's like 60 quid if you go to a nice place.
What if you're going to like the Savoy or some such? But like
your little cucumber sandwiches. You have a big kind of like
it's good fun,
tower
it's
of
good
little
fun.
Finger sandwiches.
Maybe we can get Danny more engaged.
It's a bit fusty.
Oh, through a semantic angle of entry, because my grandmother calls dinner tea. And that's quite a potent linguistic class divide in Britain, isn't it?
Very much so.
That's considered to be...
is that a working class thing?
It is. It is. Mm-hmm. Only suitable
so
for...
So, Tom, your ancestors would never say that, being
certainly not.
Tea aristocratic.
Tea means a brew, you know, mid-afternoon or first thing in the morning. What about supper? That's quite posh as well, isn't it?
But, I mean, that's...
Well, that's what Americans used to call it back in the... Not that long ago.
My kind of era.
70s.
That is premised on a 5-meal-per-diem framework, isn't it, supper?
Yeah.
Awful lot.
I'm also...
5 meals per day.
Yeah, because you have breakfast, lunch,
yeah.
Tea, not a true meal, granted, dinner.
And then what?
Supper. About 9 p.m.
Supper's after dinner.
Keep things ticking over late at night, yeah.
What would consist in a supper?
A soup normally, isn't it? It's something light.
A soup, a mess of pottage.
But warming.
Yeah.
A mess of pottage. You're a fan of a mess of pottage before bed.
Exactly.
Okay, Henry, what else is happening next week?
That's it, I'm out.
That was great.
I thought...
Was that
requisitely summary?
I loved it. We talk about
horses.
We're broadcasting
tea.
Radio waves. That was waves of sunshine, warming the face, warming the cockles My cockles are overheating. Thank you very much indeed, Henry Rhys Sheridan. This is the Monocle Summer Weekly. I'm Tom Edwards alongside Daniel Giacopelli, and we'll be hearing from the artist Eileen Cooper next.
Every summer, art lovers in London flock to one of the most, if not the most, essential events on the city's art calendar, the Royal Academy's Summer Exhibition.
Eileen Cooper has been keeper of the Royal Academy schools for the past 6 years, and she's also the person responsible for organising which of the 1,000 or so works on display each year show up on the walls. And this year, as always, there's plenty from exciting amateurs, as well as contributions from leading architects such as Jean Nouvel and Frank Gehry, and a new work from artists Gilbert and George.
Well, Eileen will be stepping down from the post at the end of the summer, so we invited her to tell us how this year's event, and many more before that, have gone. She spoke with our culture editor, Rob Bound, just a bit ago.
Eileen, thank you very much for dropping by the studio today. Congratulations on another bonanza blockbuster summer exhibition
thank
at
you.
The Royal Academy.
Thank you.
Summer exhibition, to explain to our listeners all over the world, is kind of one of the tenets of the British summer, right? It's one of the poles on which the tent of the English summer, anyway, is erected. How long has your association been with it?
So I've been an academician for 17 years, but in fact...
But time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, even as a student in the 1970s, when I was at the Royal College of Art, I first submitted work to the summer show.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had, and sometimes I've submitted over the years before I became an academician, I've been rejected. So I've had a long association with the summer show.
I mean, it's an interesting thing. People will obviously be aware of it here in the UK, but it is something, it is an open submission art
it's
show
the largest,
in the august halls of the Royal Academy. So Prince and Pauper alike,
yeah.
in artistic terms, can rock up and show
it's
their
stuff.
It's
been going for 249 years. Next year is our 250th anniversary. And it always has been a very inclusive show.
And when you were, because I know you studied at Goldsmiths in the early 70s, yeah. and you were trying to get stuff on the walls there, was there a style, was there something that you felt you should do in order to get shown at the summer exhibition, where now you're in charge of it, you know why you did or didn't get in?
I think it's hiding to nothing as an artist if you're trying to second guess what your audience might want. I think the Academy used to have a terrible reputation for being very staid. A certain kind of academic excellence in their terms was what was required. And, you know, in contemporary art, we've turned that on its head.
And now you're in charge of the submissions, presumably, of sifting through all the stuff from,
thank
from
God, not
well-known
on my own.
Artistic greats. Yeah. I know we've got Gildan George and Yonki Shinobare, I think,
inclusive, it's slightly unequal because the Royal Academicians... We hope they will put in, and therefore we don't vet their work. So we accept work by Royal Academicians. So Gilbert and George, for example, won't go through the selection process,
right.
neither will I. And there are about 100 Royal Academicians, not all of whom send in. But the 12,000 other entries all go through the panel, which is about 8 to 10 people.
And the panel is Royal Academicians.
Yeah.
How does that that sort of steering committee get made up? And do you rule, Eileen, with a rod of iron?
Typically, I do everything in a gentle, consultative way.
I thought you might.
But in the end, I will dig my heels in.
Yeah.
So putting together the panel, which starts in about October the previous year, so I've been working on this for nearly a year now, is partly by rotation. So members' names come up by rotation. But also when people say, no, I'm sorry, I'm too busy, I can't do it, we fill those spots by invitation. And for the first time ever, we have a pretty dominant female panel, mainly women, including Farshid Masavi, who's selecting architecture, and Christopher, sculpture, Rebecca Salter, who's doing printmaking, myself, Fiona Ray, painter.
So there is a why. I mean, I've always really enjoyed the architectural side of it as well, because it gives you a nice breather, because it is such a, it's a salon hang, isn't it? It goes right up to the ceiling.
Not in every room.
Not in every room, but it's a busy...
Some rooms that are incredibly busy.
Yeah.
And of course, that's part of the trade-off. If you didn't have those busy rooms, you wouldn't be able to include so many of the send-in.
Oh, no, I like it as well. I mean, because also you're so, we are so used to the White Cube, and we're so used to seeing, you know, whether it's modern, whether it's old masters even, or contemporary art, we're so used to seeing such a sober presentation of that art, works, that it is nice to see what can sometimes be a bit of a curatorial jumble. And I know you'll hate me for saying that, but I think it's such an unusual thing these days for such an august institution to do it like that. It's much in your favour.
I've heard that some young curators, it's their favourite show.
Yeah.
Because it does break down those boundaries. And we have one gallery that is very sparely hung with some of the big stars in it. But we also have a very inclusive salon hang in two or three other galleries.
And as you said, back when you were a student yourself and submitting work to the summer exhibition, there's no right way of doing it. I mean, it's curator's taste or it's chief hanger's taste. Yeah. This is also one of your titles.
Chief hanger.
Sounds very Tyburn, doesn't it? There's no right way of doing it. But what are you looking for? Are you looking for confidence with the line? Are you looking for...
Well, of course, the panel are all looking for different things. And where the richness, I think, comes is partly through our disagreement and the things that other people accept that I wouldn't particularly love. But that's the variety of it. I try to be as broad as possible. And because I've had a very long teaching career, always part-time, over 40 years, actually, I managed to tap into lots of generations of artists who, you know, I've come into contact with. And this year, I think I encouraged a lot of those people to send in. So I try to be as broad as possible. And one of the things I wanted with the summer show is that we would be inclusive in terms of materials and medium more than ever. So we've got performance this year, we've got three substantial areas of film, we've got a wonderful film installation by Isaac Julian, and we've got two filmmakers in the small Western room. As I say, performance on Friday nights.
And that's a tough sell for the summer exhibition, right? Because people associate it kind of rightly as well with, as I said, there is this sober architecture room, there is the more sober kind of contemporary room, but then there's a lot of stuff and there's a lot of paint on the walls.
Even in the architecture room, Farshid Masavi did something quite radical this year, and she encouraged people to send in working drawings. So that's a real visual feast, and there are very few models. I think there's probably half a dozen of the traditional models. So we've managed to change the feel of the show quite a lot this year.
I've bought a couple of things from the summer exhibition.
Good, that's what we like to hear.
My favourite thing, I mean, I love the show itself, obviously, which is why I bought the things, but my favourite thing was going to pick them up afterwards, when you can only do that in August when it's over, and going, and this is what everyone wants to see at the Royal Academy, is going round the back to pick your works up and seeing the schools and the life drawing classroom and all the rest of it.
That's my area.
This is the stuff. So I would encourage anyone who's listening to this to go and buy anything from the summer exhibition just so you can go and pick it up.
Because that's what
every nosy Parker wants to see.
The other wonderful thing that happens is if you buy a print and you don't get the one that's framed on the wall, you know, you buy another of the edition, then you're in touch directly with the artists.
Yeah, which is a lovely thing. And it's nice. You get sent a nice note saying thank you for buying my thing.
Yeah. And then it's up to the artist to deliver. The Academy take a third of the cost of the item, and that's your down payment. And then the artist gets in touch for the remainder of the money. So although we've sold over £4 million worth of work this year, 30% of that comes to the Academy to help us run the schools, for example, which is a free school. We charge no fees.
You have 17 students or something?
We have 17 students per year. So
yeah, that's right.
About 50.
Okay.
My maths has never been very good. and they're all postgraduate. So we give them a very high-end, very intensive experience over 3 years. It's something.
Kind of the best thing in the world, isn't it?
It is kind of amazing. And I should say, of course, that 70% of the sales go to the artists. That's a hell of a lot of money sloshing around in the summer for artists who probably, most of them, I would say 90% of those artists are probably struggling.
In terms of that, I mean, that's a wonderful thing to be what people call a Sunday painter or to be a semi-professional painter or artist from somewhere else in England or maybe from a stone's throw away in London, wherever it might be. It's wonderful for their work to be shown alongside the luminaries that you have, academicians and well-known contemporary artists alike. Yeah. How on earth do you do the hang, Eileen? How do you curate such a mixed bag of stuff?
Also, they're not just from the UK, these artists.
Yeah, no,
they are worldwide. Right, yeah. And we made a big effort to get artists worldwide to send in. And I think we've got art from every continent apart from Antarctica, which I don't think produces art.
Too bad.
Anyway, the truth is we have an amazing team of art handlers, many of whom come in to work specifically on the summer show. They're practicing artists most often, and they're the ones who help us, the academicians who are responsible for each room, to lie the work out, if it's flat work, you know, if it's paintings or if it's sculpture, to position things. And eventually we start, a wall of paintings would exist on the floor, it would be mapped out, and then slowly it's the art handlers put it on the wall.
That's the proof of the pudding, isn't it? Presumably once you've laid them out on your lovely parquet floor there in the Royal Academy.
Yes.
And trying to get a rhythm and a sense to some of these pictures, or a sense of senselessness, I don't know, yeah. however you decide to create it. But presumably there comes a point, knowing those rooms, where you're actually looking for sort of, right, we need a long, oblongy kind of picture here and a
Absolutely.
Small one that goes here. So there is a lot of practicality in your
there
hang
is,
as well.
There is, and that's where you go wandering around the other galleries trying to find something that may be unloved as yet by other academicians, and it will just fit your spot. With Bill Jacklin, who also participated this year. He's one of our RAs. I did Gallery 3, which is the largest gallery, and I think it's the biggest challenge, because if that doesn't look right and that sets the tone for the exhibition, then really it's dangerous territory if that doesn't look right. I also had to pick the colours of the walls, which is quite a challenge.
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
and terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to mention,
but you're a friend of Farrow and Ball, so that's fine.
We have Yinkshani Bari was very involved as well this year.
Yeah.
So it was a great team.
In terms of washes of colour, I mean, an artist no better known for that sort of thing himself. And what do the artists make of it? When, you know, Yinkshani Bari comes and tours the show, I'm always hoping that these great luminaries of contemporary art snaffle away a few people who they never heard of, and maybe we never will hear of. There is a great kind of personal interaction that people seem to have with the summer exhibition, great artist or not, I suppose. That's one of the reasons you're in it as well.
Yeah, I think that it's cross-generational, it's cross-cultural, something we worked on really intensively this year. And in terms of, as I said, in terms of all the different materials and processes, it's got great breadth. I know one of the things that Yinka wanted to do when he joined the committee was to encourage artists who he knew from a lot of the smaller East End galleries. And so you have a little bit of flexibility as one of the selectors, one of the hangers. You can encourage people to send in. They still have to go through the selection process. I also encouraged a lot of artists I discovered in the Contemporary African Art Fair, which was at Somerset House last year.
Which was
just amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, to spread the word about the Royal Academy and say this is a great venue to show work. This is a commercial venue for artists in some of the most beautiful galleries in the world.
And there is something, you know, the reputation of the summer exhibition, obviously, there is something lovely and old-fashioned about it, and very honest about it, it seems to me. Is that something that changes as you try, subtly it seems, to curate it and to doctor or to police in some way the sort of entries that you have in order to do the hang that you like, making sure it's egalitarian and all the rest of it? Does that change a little bit, do you wonder? Is it still that very friendly vibe?
If it doesn't change each year, then essentially you're going to be hanging the same exhibition every year. Sometimes with committees, there's terrible fallings out and people get...
This is what we like, though. We want to hear this. Well, you want people to take it seriously.
But, I have to say, with my committee, that wasn't the case, obviously.
Okay.
But you do want it to change and evolve. I was very keen to have a younger generation of artists, or not necessarily younger, an emerging generation of artists, who of course can be at any stage in their careers, to participate. And through that, I think our audience is quite sophisticated. I don't think they're just coming to see intricate paintings of cherries on plates.
Well, people also are coming to buy things.
Yeah, they are.
Because the works
massive.
Are affordable.
It's
so
massive,
it's a big thing.
Audience,
and that's why I've always found it a very open-hearted show.
I'm pleased to hear
you
you're
what I mean,
buying.
Though, because
spread the word.
People, yeah, exactly. Should we pat people on the bottom and send them to the summer exhibition
Definitely.
At the Royal Academy?
It's on till the 20th of August. And if you can't make it this year, be sure to come next year.
Or just maybe you can exhibit next year. Maybe they can...
They can certainly send in. I would say get your entry form early, because we have to cap it at 12,000 entries.
Eileen Cooper there in conversation with, appropriately enough, Monocle's culture editor. And the Royal Academy's summer exhibition concludes at the end of this week. If you're passing through London, we do recommend you head down to catch it. And you can see more of Eileen's work at the Fine Arts Society this October. Her solo show, Till the Morning Comes, will be coming to the London Gallery this autumn. This is the Monocle Summer Weekly. Time for some music now. This is a woozy new summer number from Texas songwriter Hannah Reid, better known as LaMelda. This is Out There.
And that was LaMelda with Out There. You're listening to the Monocle Summer Weekly. We're off to Brazil next.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to the Monocle Summer Weekly, and as we mentioned earlier, Monocle's four-part summer newspaper of the same name is on the shelves of all good newsstands. Now, over the space of the next month, this programme is sort of partnering up with the publication to bring you some warming tales. Well, Danny, if you like, the kind of stories you may find on the pages of the new newspaper itself.
This week we're heading to Brazil and the Paraty International Literary Festival. Paraty is a small town situated between two cultural capitals, Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, has hosted the event since 2003. It was established by British publisher Liz Calder, who envisioned a Southern Hemisphere answer to the UK's celebrated Hay Festival. Well, this year, Man Booker Prize winner Paul Beattie headlined a program of authors and speakers from more than a dozen countries. But the festival is about more than just big names, as Monocle's Frederick Burness recently discovered.
Sun, sea, sand, and literature. A dreamy long weekend for book lovers from Brazil and beyond was on offer at the 15th Paraty International Festival of Literature, known locally as FLIP. In the Colonial Historic Centre, where cars are not allowed, the cobblestone streets were flooded by streams of people. For these 5 days, the population of Paraty virtually doubled. The main square, the Praça da Matriz, was transformed into the beating heart of the festival, with a bookshop, activity areas for all ages, and an auditorium screening live transmissions of literary talks.
Era o Dropbox dele. A cópia de segurança, né?
This year, seminal Brazilian author Lima Barreto was honored with a series of events on the main program. Barreto was the grandson of African slaves. He was born in 1881, just 7 years before slavery was abolished in Brazil.
He is part of this first generation of black Brazilian writers that are growing up in this new context.
That's Felipe Botelho Correa, a historian and author who spoke at FLIP.
Some of them were very optimistic, and the importance of Lima Barreto is much more explicit about race in Brazil and the problems generated because of slavery, you know, the colonial time. And he's perhaps the most important writing emphasizing the problem of race in Brazil. And I think worldwide also the importance of Lima Barreto would be that one. What is the connection between literature, race, in the period that is just, you know, the emergence of mass society and the free world.
Botelho Correa recently discovered a lost archive of works that Lima Barreto published using false names. He says that many of Barreto's activist writings still resonate today, especially at a time of economic crisis which has exposed the gaping chasm between rich and poor in Brazil. Encouraging people to engage with those issues was a key factor behind the festival's choice to honor Barreto this year, as well as the inclusion of many more female and minority authors.
The other thing is the idea that FLIP should be more diverse and should reflect more writers and Brazilian society in general. You have to make a huge effort to actually bring those people that are considered in the periphery of this market into the mainstream. And people were kind of in doubt to see if it would actually succeed or not. And I think the festival is showing that it's also possible. And I think it should continue, and people will see that this actually works in terms of representativity and also in terms of, you know, the markets that this FLIP is all about.
Enrique Rodriguez is a writer from northern Rio de Janeiro, a cluster of humble communities which contrasts strongly with the more opulent South Zone. He's part of a very small group who have attended all 15 editions of the festival. On his first visit, Rodriguez was young and eager to learn. Today, he has published 14 books and is regularly invited to present his work, which frequently focuses on characters from invisible social groups. He says that FLIP has evolved over the years, but one thing that's remained the same is its importance for writers of any career level.
A FLIP, ela mudou algumas coisas em si, mas ela também mudou a própria concepção de eventos literários no Brasil.
FLIP has changed in itself, and it's also changed the conception of literary events in Brazil. Although this is a big country which doesn't have a huge readership, there are book fairs in several cities, and those events are defined by the sale of books. But FLIP started the idea of putting authors in the spotlight. Before, we were like an accessory on the side. It also created a boom of literary festivals which follow a similar format, which has coincided with a new connected generation of writers who are producing a great deal.
Essa rede começou a crescer de forma muito forte. Então surgiu uma geração que continua produzindo muito.
Hoje, aqui nessa cela, sob a luz da vela, o Faber-Castell Aquarelli em cima da cama de pedra.
Wandering around the well-preserved old town, you never know what you'll find. Souvenirs, poetry, music, even mini protests. There's also a huge selection of activities run by festival partners in their own spaces. One could say the official FLIP has arguably become parallel, because the parallel events now significantly outnumber the official festival.
Então, a Casa do Papel é uma realização da Fedrigoni Brasil Papéis, uma fabricante de papéis especiais.
The Casa do Papel, or Paper House, lies across a bridge from the historic center. It offered workshops focused on artisanal techniques like screen printing, bookbinding and typography, as well as debates, film screenings and live bands. The Casa was created by a group of publishing organizations with the support of a paper manufacturing company. One of its producers, Celia Arbolavi, told me the independent publishing scene in São Paulo is going from strength to strength.
here in Brazil, there are lots of artists that are really like pushing the limits forward. Because they these artists can't make huge print runs, they have to do small print runs because of the economical reasons, like they don't have money to do a print run of 2,000 copies. They do small print runs and they do very different things that you don't see in normal bookstores. So that limitation ended up provoking this huge production that is very creative, very different. And I think that they are really like inventing and creating things that haven't been made before. So it's a very, very exciting moment. Entrando em cena, fazendo outro esquema, baixando a linha,
dois compassos, dois por dois, partiu, sem nenhum problema. Just down the road from the Casa do Papel, I found a live hip-hop performance on Friday night. It was part of another parallel project, a mobile museum with interactive exhibits, videos, and games. When Sao Paulo's Museum of the Portuguese Language tragically burned down in late 2015, an energy company promised to keep its spirit alive with a traveling show that is crisscrossing Brazil. Here's Widna Conceição, one of the guides.
É uma parede com certas expressões que a gente usa no dia a dia e que a gente até sabe o significado, mas não conhece a origem.
This is a wall with everyday expressions. We all understand the meanings, but lots of people don't know where they came from, even though we say these things all the time. We also have an accent generator and a virtual tour of Lusophone countries. What we're doing here is just a fraction of the old museum, but at least we can keep it going while the new one is built. It will open in 2019.
Se eu não me engano, a partir de 2019 estará pronto e aberto para o público.
That was only a taste of Flip 2017. Like so many other festivals, it was impossible to keep track of everything. And part of the fun is seeing where the flow takes you. Brazil's difficult financial situation meant Flip had a lean budget, but that didn't seem to discourage visitors. In fact, it might even have had the opposite effect, as the production team decided to build a larger open viewing pavilion than previous festivals, with no ticket required. Organizers say the diverse author lineup attracted new audiences, but that media coverage failed to reflect that spirit of inclusivity. Here's Jocelia Aguiar, the festival curator.
A gente conseguiu 24 mulheres, quer dizer, metade, né? Pela primeira vez.
We had 24 women, which is half, and it was the first time. But I think that actually confused people from the traditional press, because they didn't understand that they should be covering the books and the authors, not just the fact that they were black or female. That's really the only thing they talked about, and it feels like they still have a certain prejudice. The big media companies are more interested in what's happening in New York than the independent publishing scene here in Brazil.
É como se a grande imprensa aqui está mais interessada em saber o que está acontecendo em Nova York.
A different curator is selected for every edition of Flip, but Aguiar hopes she has initiated a paradigm shift and that the emphasis on representing marginal voices will continue for many years to come. For Monocle, in Paraty, Brazil, I'm Frederick Bernas.
The Paraty International Literary Festival there. Monocle's man, Frederick Bernas, reporting. Thanks to him. We'll be bringing you more windows into a summertime spent well over the coming weeks. And do head to your local newsstand to pick up your copy of the Monocle Summer Weekly too. We'll be hearing from Portuguese street artist Vils after this.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24 weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Buckle up, put the armrest down, and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
Vils is the street artist from Lisbon whose work has been compared to the greats of the field, such as Banksy and Blue. But Vils' signature style is something a little different. He uses drilling to carve detailed works into the concrete spaces that surround us, with permission, one would hope.
Monocle's Tom Hall recently met Vils at the Imminente Festival in London, which he'd curated to learn more about the art scene in Portugal and how Vils goes about creating those works.
What I usually do, I work with hammer drills and hammers and chisels and so on. So what I often do is I go on walls and instead of adding paint, I extract the layers of the wall. So it's kind of a contemporary archaeologist process of the cities where I go and do projects. And basically that's the concept of revealing all the layers of that the walls in the city have in them by an act of destruction that creates something, that makes something that is invisible visible on the walls in different cities. The relation that I have with London is quite strong because I lived here for 7 years and it was a huge influence for me with all the projects that we did from Cannes Festival to different other projects. So for me it was really meaningful to do these projects back in London after all these years that I was here.
We should sort of tell listeners about what it is we're seeing. I mean, you've got a piece over here which is carved from a piece of enormous concrete. And this isn't just a case of you taking a jackhammer to a wall and making a mess. These are like really, really intricate, beautiful, detailed portraits of people. And it's quite jarring to see that this sort of slightly destructive process could create something quite so beautiful. But does everyone see it like that? Because you are essentially taking a drill to a wall. I mean, I assume you maybe got in some trouble maybe in the past before.
For sure. I mean, I started as a graffiti writer doing mostly illegal stuff, which was part of my background. And definitely this idea of doing something by yourself, DIY kind of posture, it was there because of graffiti. But the work evolved a lot. Conceptually and the reasons why I was doing and the carvings that I told you, I eventually did it on walls, billboards and so on. And of course, some people saw it as vandalism, which I completely accept. But I often work with places that are forgotten by the city. So the fact that you can actually carefully take care of a wall and peel those layers to create something beautiful that will create and resonate to people, it's something that is very impactful, not just for me, but for the place that is being done, but also for the city to claim attention to those places. What we're going to see here in the festival is a different concept and a place that people are coming to receive an input.
Tell us about some of these artists then. I mean, we've got a real spread. We've got people from all over Europe, all over the globe, really. But you do have a pick of also some Portuguese artists in, you know, both musicians and street artists too. Tell us what we can expect from Portugal and what it is about the Portuguese art scene that you think should be shown more to the world.
The idea was not to centralize it completely on Portuguese artists. Of course, as I grew up there, there's a lot of artists that I respect and that I wanted to work with them here. And we all came together to do something very specific and special. But we have artists from Ireland, from completely different places. And what we were trying to do is to show, you know, the potential on when people can work together or with a common objective. Because with visual artists, usually you don't have the barriers of languages, of cultures and everything, because people go on and have a common goal, a common objective of showing their art, claim attention to issues that art can do. And I think what we try to show here is that when we work together with a common goal, things can be quite special. But yeah, we have several artists and musicians from all over, and that was the main objective of the festival. They are quite diverse, but I think we all have a common link, which is we all grew up in urban places, and we all represent urban culture, which I'm very related to, but I think as a whole, we all have that in common. And both in music and art, we can see some threads where we all connect besides our backgrounds, cultures and histories.
Do you think it's too simple a notion? You know, we look at Portugal, we see it has nicer weather than us here in London. You know, you have access to the Mediterranean Sea. It is a different lifestyle a little bit. I mean, do you think that that does feed into some of the identity of some of the art that you see coming out of Portugal? I mean, does Portugal have an artistic character?
For the artists that are here that come from Portugal, I think you can see clearly that. I think Portugal always had a very strong relationship with other countries that speak Portuguese, Empire. Which have very bad things too, historically, but it came down to a moment where we all grew in the suburbs of Lisbon, where we had, or Porto, where we have people that come from everywhere. And I think all these influences from different places came to a very specific linkage in terms of music, in terms of art. And I think this is being reflected in this generation, because we had a revolution in 74. The country just 40, 50 years ago was in a very...
Someone just dropped something and caused a minor stir there. We'll come back to the question now. Please do go on.
Basically, I think it's a very microcosmos that was bubbling for a long time. And I think what came out of it was this really unique music that is popping out from there, but also art in terms of arts. There is a lot of things happening also. So I think there is very specifics, but also, you know, London was a big part of me too. So I guess today in a globalized world, I believe we are influenced by all these things that surround us.
Finally, I was looking at your piece earlier, as I was explaining to listeners, it's this sort of concrete monolith. It looks about 10 feet high, 8 feet wide, and you've drilled these sort of little chasms into it, and you've created this incredibly intricate portrait of a figure. Tell us a little bit about what that artwork is. Do we know who this person is, or is it just a creative vision? What is it?
No, usually I work with unknown icons, so people that I everyday heroes that live in the cities where I work. I do a series of portraits and I try to capture the essence of the city, and this was one of the first sets of drawings that I did when I was living in London. And then I did a big research on top views of the city that kind of creates this maquette of a city that it's made from different parts of London that then compose the portrait. And the whole idea of the piece is, you know, it's like something that crystallizes how we are shaped by what surrounds us, by the cities where we come from, by everything that we do, and how little sometimes we affect the place where we live. And that's basically the whole motto and the concept behind the work that is there.
That's fascinating. So within that detail of the facial marks and things like that, you've worked in, I guess, the geography of London as well.
Yeah, that's what you can find there.
That was Vils speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. You're listening to the Monocle Summer Weekly. Well, there we go, Danny. The Monocle Summer Weekly bites the dust. Another edition of the programme safely in the can. I'm feeling pretty sun-kissed already, and I haven't even ventured outside.
You're not? Are you going on any holidays in the coming weeks, Tom? To the beach?
I'm doing what, sadly, in portmanteau land is known as a staycation. Yeah. Early in September, staying here in Blighty. So chances are I won't get much sunshine.
Rainy England.
No, heading up to Norfolk. Lovely part of the world. International listeners. You know, it's a left-field choice. What about you, Danny? Got any far-flung destinations in mind, or are you heading back to the motherland?
I'm back to the motherland for about a week and a half, starting on Wednesday. Can't wait to get out there with the dogs, the family, the beach, pizza, bagels, everything that we don't do in this country, or we do poorly.
Certainly sounds like fun, Danny. And may I wish you, our listeners, wherever you are in the world, happy travels or happy listening if you're curled up on a lounger or if you're strolling around somewhere sun-kissed. Or even, actually, if you're somewhere struck by seasonal showers. Hopefully the Monocle Summer Weekly has provided a bit of sunshine for you. That's all we have time for this week. More Summer Weekly fare 7 days from now. In the meantime, though, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Daniel Giacopelli.
It's goodbye, and thank you for listening.